This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Judy Rebick supports Rabble because
Rabble's one of the very few spaces anywhere that you get a variety of views. All the new movements that emerged in Canada, whether it was Idle No More, the Maple Spring, the first place they appear is on Rabble.
Thanks, Judy. Just a few reasons to support Rabble.ca. Go to www.rabble.ca/donate.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
So it's a great time of hope for all of us in this country. There's a chance for all of us to make a difference. And some of the problems that we're confronting are very difficult problems. They were willed to us by the previous generation who looked the other way, who thought that solving them was impossible, and some even thought that solving them wasn't necessary. I think that's why I hang out with children so much. They make a lot of sense. And they can see things that we somehow make soft and comfortable when we grow up. They remind us to bring the very best of ourselves to the world. You have a child in your life, you want to be on your best behavior. You want to give them the life that's even better than yours. It's something that unifies all people of all cultures. This desire to give a child the childhood that they feel proud of. A childhood they don't have to recover from. Recently, I was walking with a little girl and one of my friends, Charlene Bearhead, along a street in Ottawa. And we know that there are some children for whom home is not a safe place. There are some places, some houses, where there are things that make children uncomfortable and unsafe. And we're walking along with this 9-year-old non-Aboriginal girl. And we came upon a house. And she stopped and she said, "Can you see what they're doing there?" And Charlene and I, as adults, we looked and we saw the obvious, of course. "They're laying sod," we said. She said, "No, that's not what they're doing. They're trying to make it look beautiful. And what happens in that house is not beautiful for children." The house she was talking about was the House of Commons. Now, what did this 9-year-old non-Aboriginal girl know about what happens for kids in this place? Well, she knows about residential schools. And thanks to the courageous survivors, many of us are becoming more aware of that tragic time in history. But what you're seeing behind you is a document dated 1895. If we could have blown it up even more, you would have seen the signature of Duncan Campbell Scott. Some of you would have learned about his poetry in Canadian poetry. But he was also the superintendent of Indian Affairs. And along with the Prime Minister Macdonald, was one of the architects of the residential school system. What a lot of folks don't know, however, is that residential schools are the earliest form of child welfare in Canada. This actual document behind it is a warrant. It allows for the removal of First Nations children from their families for the purposes of education, which we all know was not education, it was assimilation, and because they were not properly cared for. Now, not properly cared for is a pretty loaded thing. And in this case, many of these children were loved and cared for by their families, but they were being raised in a culture that the Indian agents felt should be eradicated. And therefore, children were removed from their families and placed into schools. This predates actually even the development of non-Aboriginal child welfare. So it's important to understand that residential schools were child welfare placements. And in fact, as the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples found, Over time, they became even more and more often used for child welfare. By 1967, there's a guy named Caldwell, and he goes in and studies children in residential schools in Saskatchewan. In that year, he finds 80% of the children there were placed there as child welfare placements. So it was used as child welfare. And then we had the schools starting to close in the 1940s and then being replaced by the child welfare system itself. So it's important to look at this history, because as we come to terms with this as a country, we need to ask ourselves what reconciliation means to us. Now, I'm a very simplistic thinker, maybe because I'm a girl from the bush. We just look at the obvious. And to me, reconciliation really, at the end of the day, means not saying sorry twice. It means doing right by this generation of children. It means honoring the lessons that we learned from this process. It's not enough to say it happened. We have to learn from it. So let's roll the tape forward. I had the honor of going to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission hearings in Edmonton. And 4 days later, I walked into the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal, where the Canadian government was on trial for its contemporary discrimination against First Nations children. We're going to talk about that case and the evidence in a minute. But let's talk about what we know. What the Auditor General, the Parliamentary Budget Officer, internal government reports by the dozens have confirmed is that although First Nations traditional laws have been displaced off reserve, ignored by provincial governments, the reality is they do apply. That is a matter of controversy because the laws really don't service First Nations children that well. But nonetheless, they apply. But the federal government funds the services on reserve, and off reserve, they're funded by all others. So let's take an example. It's not to do with remoteness. Think about the Squamish Nation, right, in North Vancouver. Just across the street, the province will fund those services. On reserve, the federal government will fund those services. And as the Auditor General has said time and time again, in areas like child welfare, education, health, these kids get less than every other Canadian. And yet they're judged as if they get more. And in fact, we get a lot of spin from the government where they actually feed in my view, to that type of stereotype. So how is it that we have allowed this to happen? How is it that in a country as good and great as Canada, filled with so many caring people who believe in equality and fairness, that we actually are allowing a government to racially discriminate against kids? How is that happening? Well, when I listen to, I'd be interested in your views, but some of the spin I hear is this. You'll hear government say, for example, First Nations are too remote. That's the reason they don't get the services everybody else has. Who's heard that? Yeah? You notice they only talk about that. They only use that word remote when they're talking about people. They never will say, those oil sands are too remote. That uranium, we can't do it. And that ship buried under the Arctic Ocean will never find it. Our most precious resource we have in this country is our kids. Most precious resource. It's not about remoteness. Then we have Aboriginal people. It's complicated. In the example I'm going to show you in child welfare and in many others, it's not complicated. It's complicated to perpetuate racism and discrimination. It's not complicated to do equality. These are solutions that are available to the government. And think about it this way. They'll say one in six First Nations do not have clean water to drink. This is in one of the wealthiest countries in the world. But we can fly a DART team halfway around the world in an earthquake zone and have clean water pumping in 24 hours. So why can't we do that in Taganega First Nation an hour and a half outside of Toronto? And then there's the one about the money. First Nations cannot be trusted with the money. We cannot provide, we need more accountability on behalf of First Nations before we're going to put out more money out the door. And this is what we've heard a lot on First Nations education. Now, think about it for a moment. Am I the only one? Maybe because I live in Ottawa, and to the east we have Montreal, which is basically went through, I think, 4 mayors in 1 year for corruption charges. No one suggested that the people of Montreal who elected those people, those kids should get a 30% cut in their services from the federal government, and no one should fund it. And then we have Toronto to the west. I wouldn't laugh if I were you, because I know the history of the BC premiers, right? But I mean, things have kind of seemed calmed down the last few years, but there's no other people that we would allow for them to, their kids to be racially discriminated against because of what is clearly a stereotype, a racial stereotype. That's not to say that there aren't First Nations people who are fraudulent. Clearly there are. But it is no evidence that it's overrepresented amongst First Nations people. You will find that in every single population. And children should not be penalized because of that. Should not be penalized because of that. There's another thing that allows it to happen, and sometimes we as First Nations need to embrace this responsibility, and that's because we become used to incremental equality. We've been so unequal for so long. We're happy to get just a little bit more. And so there's a political announcement where we get a little bit more, but it's not equal. And then the Canadian public, in fairness to the Canadian public, they hear all this money going out the door, but what they don't hear is that it's still 30% less than what a non-Aboriginal child would get. And we have gotten used to this incremental equality idea. The problem with incremental equality is it never comes. I have a report in my office. It's written in typewriter. It says, can anyone hazard a guess as when there will be real equality for Indian children? That was written in 1967. I was 3 years old. We're still at it. We'll still be at it another 50 years from now unless we as a country firmly believe that when we sing O Canada, that means justice, fairness, and respect for all kids. And we demand it of anyone who ever holds political office. That we no longer tolerate racial discrimination against children as a fiscal restraint measure in this country. I think there's two populations in my heart that I think always deserve the best from our country. One is our seniors and our veterans, and the others is our kids. And as the 11th wealthiest nation in the world, I think we can afford to do both. Why is this question of inequality, why is it bad for everybody else? You know, you can just kind of say, well, it's bad for First Nations. This is a great book I recommend to everyone to read. It's called The Spirit Level. And there's a website that goes with it, gapminder.org. For those of you who are teachers or you're in academia, you'll want to take a look at this website. Because basically what it does is it shows you that if I was wanting to become an elected official, say if I took over Ottawa for a day, I'd actually get rid of a lot of the stuff, and I'd focus on one thing, and that's reducing the inequalities in our own country. Because if you reduce the inequalities in your own country, you decrease crime rates, you decrease mental health issues, you increase trust in your communities, you increase education rates, you decrease substance misuse issues. You get a robust economy. All of these good things happen when you reduce inequality. The problem for Canada is that our inequality gap is growing, not lessening, amongst OECD countries. So we're actually going in the reverse direction. And so what are we doing in our public policy? We're building more jails, getting tough on crime, none of which helps, right? If we would reduce the inequalities and the injustices in our society facing so many people, not just First Nations, others as well, we would be far further ahead as a people. So here's where we are in a world economy, right? It's 11th in the world. We're the 11th richest country in the world out of roughly 193 nations. This is according to the World Bank. These are their figures of last year. And we're coming into election cycle here federally. And you're going to hear just about every candidate say, vote for me because I'm going to give you a job. Yeah, I'm all about jobs. And if you vote for me, you're going to get a job and you'll be able to look after your family. The problem is there's not a lot of evidence that's true. If we are the 11th richest country in the world, Where do you think Canada would rank in terms of its treatment of children in the world if it was going, if it was really doing everything it could for kids? Wouldn't you think we'd be at 11 or better? Well, last year, there was a great organization called the Children's Rights Organization, Kids Rights Foundation, pardon me. It partners with the Nobel laureates every year to give out the International Children's Peace Prize. Malala won it last year, right? So this is probably one of the most prestigious kids' rights organizations in the world. And they thought, we're going to partner with the School of Economics in the EU, and we're going to find out if we ranked all these countries in the world, and we ask the question, how well are they doing for kids proportionate to their wealth? How well would they do? Well, Canada's results came out as shocking, according to the researchers. It was one of four countries that got a shocking result. This is where we ranked 60th in the world, 60 in the world. And in the sub-index that deals with government powers, which is legislation and budgets, we ranked 115th in the world. So what is the company at 115 in the world? Well, the Russian Federation is 117 in the world. So we are not doing as well as we could be doing as a country at any level of government. We're doing as well as Vladimir Putin is doing for the children in the Russian Federation. So we cannot accept this argument from any level of government that they're doing enough for kids, because it's not showing up in the data, and it's not showing up in your families either. You need only look in your communities to see why is it that we have kids who are going hungry in this kind of country, right? No, there's no reason for it. A 9-year-old girl gave me the very best definition of discrimination I think I ever thought of. She said, you know what discrimination is, Cindy? She said, discrimination is when the government doesn't think you're worth the money. So what does it feel like to be one of these kids who's not worth the money? What would it feel like if you're the parent or grandparent or uncle or aunt of one of these children who's not worth the money? How would it feel? This is Jordan River Anderson. He is born in Norway House Cree Nation in 1999 to a large family. His mother had to give birth to him in a Winnipeg Children's Hospital until he recovered from a medical problem. He stayed there for 2 years. But on his second birthday, he was ready to go home, and he would have gone home had he been a non-Aboriginal child, because the province would have paid for his medical care. But because he was First Nations, a dispute started within the federal government, between departments, and with the government of Manitoba about who should pay for his at-home care. So the decision by all the bureaucrats was to leave him in the hospital while they argued over who should pay. This little baby spent over 2.5 years unnecessarily in the hospital. I've met some of Jordan's doctors who were pleading with the government to allow this kid to go home, along with the family members. Let's face it, a hospital is no place for a child to grow up when they don't have to. But nothing seemed to move that mound. The governments were concerned about not setting a precedent. We don't want to pick up somebody else's cost. And so it was that Jordan, in the end, died of a broken heart. He dies in hospital just before his fifth birthday, never having spent a day in a family home because of who he was. This is in 2005. At the time of his death, his family asked that we work with them to never let this happen to another child. It was heartbreaking for them. And we knew it was. We knew that there were, in a study of just 12 of the First Nations agency, we knew 493 other situations were happening, and just 12 of those sample of the 108. So we went to the government of Canada, and we created with the family and with the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs and Assembly of First Nations, Jordan's Principle. It's very simple. It says, where a government service is available to all other kids, let First Nations kids access it on the same terms. And figure out any payment issues second, behind the scenes. You can figure that out after, but let the child get their services met. It was passed unanimously in the House of Commons on December 7th or 12th, 2007. Should have been the end of it. I remember Ernest was there, Jordan's dad, that day, and as they all stood up and gave him a standing ovation, he looked down over the gallery bar, and he saluted them, but he said, Don't let the good done in my son's name today just be a moral victory. I want lives to change for children. So one of the things I'd like you to do is sign up for Jordan's Principle, because sadly, it's never really been implemented. The federal government immediately started to narrow it. It said, no, First Nations children shouldn't be able to access all services, just complex medical needs of multiple service providers. Now, they also put up the system that was so hard to navigate or even find anything about that no one could access it. I'm going to introduce you to one of my heroes, Marina Beadle. You can see her there. She's a proud Mi'kmaq Nation woman, a single mother of two boys. And this is Jeremy in the photo. She would want you first to know that he is a very musical young boy, very artistic. He also fits squarely within Canada's definition, doesn't he? But she provided care for Jeremy with almost no services. We all know for persons with disabilities off reserve, there's almost nothing. And on reserve, there's even less. But she did. She said to me, she says, the greatest gift and honor ever in my life was being a mother. I think some of you can relate to that, right? You're proud of what you do in your work. But for most of you, that's the best thing that ever happened to you. It's being a brother, a sister, an aunt, an uncle, a friend to a kid. And she said, I'd always sleep lightly so that if Jeremy needed anything, I'd wake up so I could help him. Until one night when she had a double stroke when Jeremy was 15 years old. All she wanted was respite care for Jeremy's physical needs until she got better. That's it. And a Supreme Court in Nova Scotia decision said off reserve, that's exactly what would be provided. You had sent in medical professionals who would assess the level of care, and then that would be provided by the provincial government in Nova Scotia. Federal government says, we're not going to pay attention to that Supreme Court of Nova Scotia decision. All we're prepared to provide is a fixed level of care. And all the health professionals said that that was not enough for Jeremy's needs. So in email exchanges between federal government officials that happened behind the scenes, which would come out in court later, we know they set out really three options for Marina. Number one, she could place him in an institution and the federal government would pay for that. Number two, things could deteriorate so badly in the family home that child welfare would have to intervene and that would be paid for. Or number three, this small First Nation and this mother who's an elder caring for a high special needs child recovering from a double stroke could fundraise for the additional amount. So what does this lady do? What would any of you do in that circumstance? This courageous woman says, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing it for my son, and I want doing it because of other children out there just like us. So she takes the federal government to court. She alleges what the federal government is doing is illegal, and the federal court agrees. The federal court finds that Canada's definition of Jordan's Principle is unlawful. It orders the government to pay for Jeremy's care. And the federal government's response, they immediately appeal. And guess who they want their legal fees from? Marina Beadle. For a year, they put her under the stress of losing the little income she had. But this is not a woman to be dissuaded. She said, I've always stood up for the right thing. And I'm not going to be scared off. Weeks before it was to go to the Federal Court of Appeal, the Canadian government, on 4:30 on a Friday, withdrew their appeal. So this is actual case law that now stands in the Government of Canada. Which is great, because they can no longer say there are no Jordan's Principle cases. But this little victory is just, I'm going to show you some other documents that we got at the tribunal that shows how these inequalities. This is from British Columbia. None of you have ever seen this document, I don't think, okay? This is an internal document. It was worked on between the Ministry of Child and Family Development and Indian Affairs, and it was identifying gaps in service providers for kids on and off reserve. Now, I can't show you the whole document, but I'll read that last paragraph. It says, the work of the two departments on Jordan's Principle has highlighted what all of us knew from years of experience, that there are differences of opinion, authorities, and resources between the two departments that appear to cause gaps in services to children and families resident on reserve. The main programs that it issue include INAC's Income Assistance Program and the Child and Family Service Program for Health Canada, its non-insured health benefits. So this same document goes on to enumerate some of these gaps in services that Kids on Reserve experience here in BC. And there are things like orthodontic care, or if there's drug ordered drug testing, they won't pay for that. Basic medical equipment, they won't pay for. Mental health services. And think about this. This is just because you're across an imaginary line, right? That's all it is. An imaginary line drawn by the governments. So let's take a look at an example. This is another federal government document. It was written internally by Department of Indian Affairs and Health Canada officials. And they are enumerating examples of these gaps. Again, there are a series of examples like this. But as you can see here, what they're talking about is if you're a child on reserve, and say you're a child with a disability, and you require a wheelchair, a stroller, and a lift. That's not unusual, right? If you're that child off reserve, you will get all of those items. If you are that child on reserve, you get one of those items every 5 years, and the lift has to be self-installed. Now, I am a little bit of a handy woman. At least I like to think that. I'm reasonably okay at the basic fix-it jobs. But there's no way I would ever sleep at night if I had to install a lift for a child in a wheelchair. And I don't think there's very many of us in this room that would, right? Now, that's just one example, but there were other examples like orthodontic care. There's a government document that says that children on reserve only receive orthodontic care if they cannot eat or cannot talk. And they actually encourage the pulling of teeth because it's cheaper than getting orthodontic care. And this is what you have to do is once you get the orthodontic care, where they say that you have to get this, you have to apply to get it covered. And this is a presentation from Health Canada about the turnaround times, how long it takes for that first approval process to happen. Now, this doesn't take into account you having to run over to the dentist and get all the reports and everything, or the time in mail. This is the time from when they receive it to the time they send it out. And you can see there, who here has had a root canal? How would you like to wait another 40 days on top of what you did? Not many, right? Crowns, 40 days. Complex extractions, 27 days. And think, these would be bad enough for you and I as adults. But think about it if it's a child, right? You know, my mom has got a great thing she used to say to me quite often. She would always say, well, Cindy, there's no excuse for that when it came to behavior. Sometimes she was right. But when I look at this, I also think there's no excuse for this. There really isn't any excuse for this. Not in a country as good as ours. And another example that really kind of, we're going to talk about the tribunal here in a second, and I had to testify to some of the documents, the internal government documents, some of which you've seen. And I had to read them before I testified on the stand. But then the moment I took the stand, I was under what I call the cone of silence. I couldn't talk to my lawyer, couldn't talk to anybody. I was in the cone of silence for 5 days. And there was one document that just literally made me sick. It was a 9-year-old girl. She's terminally ill. She requires a hospital bed at a 30% incline to keep her from going into respiratory distress. The Government of Canada and Health Canada fought for at least 9 months, if not a year, before they gave her that. And they thought it was a success. You know, she just wanted to breathe, right? If we can send an astronaut up to space and give him a Twitter account, we can afford to make sure that a child in the last few days of her life lives with comfort and dignity. Now, what about child welfare? A lot of us talk about residential schools or the 60s group as if they're over. But one of the documents filed at the tribunal showed how many First Nations children are being removed from the care today. And in fact, it's even more than in residential schools. And the reason for it is not abuse. That's not to say abuse does not happen in our communities. We need to own that and be accountable for it. It's completely unacceptable. But that's not what drives the overrepresentation. It's poverty, poor housing, and substance misuse related to residential schools. All things we could do something about with proper services. Now, you can think about it as being 12 times more likely to end up in foster care, according to the Canadian Incident Study on Child Abuse and Neglect. You can think about it here in the province of British Columbia. Over half of the kids in care are Aboriginal kids, right? Or you can think about it the way kids themselves think about it, which is, how many sleeps until I see my dad? This spreadsheet filed by the government added up the number of nights that First Nations children spent in foster care, and these are kids on reserve only, and in the Yukon, between 1989 and 2012, excluding Ontario data for 2011. So this is a lowball figure, is what I'm telling you. It's 66 million nights away from their families, or 187,000 years of childhood. Now, I did child protection on the front lines, and I'm here to tell you that some children do need to be in foster care, but not at these rates and not for these reasons. And a lot of kids who have been in foster care, they'll tell you. They'll say the nights are the hardest. During the day, you can keep yourself busy with your friends at school or things, but at night when you're there by yourself and you're going to bed, that's when all these thoughts come to you, right? So we had worked with the federal government for over 10 years documenting the inequality and developing evidence-based solutions and quantifying it. I need to tell you that although I'm critical of the government, I don't criticize them unless we've been part of the solution. It's not enough just to point out a problem. You've got to be there to do something for kids that works. We did that for over 10 years. The federal government agreed with both of those. We have letters on file from the minister, et cetera, thank you for the great work. But they walked away from it. And the problem with that, of waiting for the federal government to do the right thing, is if you track it right back to residential schools, there's never been a time in the history of this country when they've treated First Nations kids fairly. So how long are you going to wait? Kids only have one childhood. So in 2007, we filed a human rights complaint against the federal government, alleging that their inequitable and flawed provision of child welfare and their failure to implement Jordan's principle was discriminatory under the Canadian Human Rights Act. The feds would spend $3.5 million and 6 years trying to get it derailed on legal technicalities. Their arguments are basically this: it's unfair to compare our level of funding, the federal funding, to what the provinces get. That's not fair to us as a federal government. Second argument is, we don't directly deliver child welfare. The federal government provides funding to First Nations agencies who employ social workers. So if that social worker is delivering an inequitable level of service, it's the social worker who's responsible, not us as the federal government. It's the second argument. Third argument is, this is not the proper forum for the case. We value the Canadian Human Rights Commission and they have tribunal, but this is not the proper forum. They don't name what the proper forum is. And clearly it wasn't negotiation and working together, because we had tried that for a decade. Those are the three arguments. Fortunately, we went all the way to the Federal Court of Appeal, which is one level below the Supreme Court, but they all ruled against Canada and forced a hearing on the merits. So for the first time in the world ever, on February 25th, 2013, a government went on trial for its contemporary treatment of children. Not as a way of blaming, although we're going to get a finding whether they discriminated or not. This is not about, let's say sorry and feel bad about things. It's about, let's do right by the kids for the future generations. Right? Let's fix this problem. If it has to be by court order, let it come. Now, when we filed that case, I'll never, ever forget. It was just about 8 years ago now. And I was walking out of Parliament. We just had a news conference. The National Chief, Phil Fontaine, was there. And I could hear the sound of my footsteps on the concrete. Why? Because there was nobody there. This was, in my view, one of the most important human rights cases of our time. Not just for First Nations people, but this puts a red-hot poker stick into the conscience of every moral human being in the country. And nobody was there. Now, I couldn't believe that people didn't care, or they think we deserve it, but I actually don't believe that. I, like many other people, believe in the goodness of caring Canadians. We felt if we provided them with the information, not asking them to draw an opinion or take a side, but simply peel back the layers so people could see what we see and then make up their own minds about the case, people would start coming. And that's why we created the I Am a Witness campaign. So if you go onto this website, you're going to see all the Government of Canada's court documents, all of our court documents. We don't ask you to take a side, we just simply ask you to watch. And thanks to Aboriginal People's Television taking the federal government to court, they were able to film all the hearings. So you can watch all the hearings firsthand. Now, you can see there we've gone up from zero to 13,000. It's the most watched human rights case in Canadian history. It may be the most watched human rights case in North America. So how did we get there? Was it because a lot of adults decided to rally around? Not exactly. The first people who started showing up at the hearings were about that old. See, they started with a group of teenagers who came to the hearings. And one of the young men came up and he said, "We're from alternative school, which means we get into trouble a lot." I said, "Good, because so do I." I said, "I just try to get into trouble for doing the right things more often at my age." And he said, "Sometimes we deserve it, but sometimes it's these stupid systems that deserve it, and nobody ever takes them on. But you are, and that's why we're here. And you want our help, so that's why we're going to stay." They stayed for the first 2 days of the hearing. And then they came back several weeks later, but they were wearing new apparel. They had designed I Am a Witness t-shirts, and they brought the rest of their high school colleagues with them, and their younger brothers and sisters. Meanwhile, we have this great heroine, Shannon Kustachin, a First Nations girl advocating for proper schools, because these inequalities echo across other areas of experience, where she was asking kids to write letters. So by 2012, we had so many children attending the hearings that we had to move the hearings to the Supreme Court of Canada and have the kids booked in shifts. So this is us in 2012. And I remember the security guard at the Supreme Court of Canada, he said, "It's like a daycare in here today." And then at the end of the day, he said, "You know what? These kids are better behaved than most of the people who come here." And so imagine yourself. You're seeing this play out in a courtroom. You have the Government of Canada making those legal and technical arguments, and you have us arguing to want to bring forward these facts and talk about what's good for kids. How would it make you feel to see that audience? So what do you think the kids thought about this, sitting in that audience? There's a little guy during the coffee break, and he comes out, and I was heading over to the ladies' room. And he says, "First of all, there's something really important you need to know. There's marble in there." He said, "This is a fancy place." I said, "Okay," and there was. And he said, "This is the best place to sit, because we're getting all the autographs of the lawyers. And they know who the lawyers are because they're wearing those long black capes. They have autographs, and they're getting everybody, right? Including the Government of Canada." So I said, "Well, how has it been going? What have you been watching?" He said, "Well, you know, I remember when you came to our school, and you told us that being a witness is like being a newspaper reporter. That you don't just believe something because someone tells you. That you got to go listen to all sides of the story, and then you talk to your mom and dad, or you talk to your teacher, and you decide what you feel about it." So he said, "I'd already heard you, so I came for the government side. Hear what the government had to say." And I said, "So what did you learn?" So he whips out this foolscap piece of paper, line drawn down the middle, with all these tallies on one side. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, big long list. And on the other side, there was a shorter list. And I said, "Well, what is it?" He said, "The long list is when the judge asked the Canada people a question, and the short list is when they answered." I think he should try that in question period. So the kids saw the evidence, and I'm going to take you through some of that right now. This actually was on Indian Affairs' website in 2007. I actually screenshot and printed it off at the time. If you would have been on there in 2007, you would have read this piece, "Changes in Landscape. Provinces and territories have introduced new policy approaches to child welfare and a broader continuum of services and programs that First Nations Child and Family Service agencies must deliver to retain their provincial mandates." However, current funding approach, federal funding approach to child and family services has not let First Nations child and family service agencies keep pace with provincial and territorial province policy changes. And therefore, the First Nations child and family service agencies are unable to deliver the full continuum of services offered by the provinces and the territories to other Canadians. This is their own website. Right? Now, the funding formula they use here in BC, there's three formulas they apply across the country. The one in BC provides the lowest level of funding. Kids in BC are the most disadvantaged. And just to give you a sense of how old this thing is, it was developed in 1989, which I think was Taylor Swift's birthday, right? Was that it? With her album? And if we think back to 1989, the World Wide Web was just being discovered in Europe, right? No internet. Now, there has been no increase in this formula for prevention services in 24 years. Is there anyone in this audience that's 24? You are? Can you stand up? So when she was a baby, they did the last increase in prevention. Thank you. There's been no increase in inflation for 18 years. 18 years. And what has that meant? That just in inflation losses alone, we've lost 21 cents on the dollar. There's no increase in salaries for 18 years, right? So these social workers are being paid at these salaries from 18 years ago. And if the agencies want to keep qualified people, then they have to spend money that comes out of that limited prevention pool, right? And the amount of money that they give for legal is $5,000. That's supposed to take care of all your corporate legal, like your human resources legal, incorporating, as well as all your child and care related legal, all your costs for inquiries. So this is the formula that's currently applied here in British Columbia. And here's how much the federal government says that they're shortfalling now. So this is an internal federal government document being presented. I believe this one is going to, this is a director general, so that's going to the ADM, I think, Assistant Deputy Minister in Ottawa. And you can see that this is a secret PowerPoint, but not so secret anymore, and October 31st. And you can see that they think how much they're shortfalling in child welfare, right? So these are documents we're filing that they have written. And this builds on the findings of the Auditor General, who specifically looked at child and family services and found it to be flawed and inequitable in 2008. So what we see here, in some ways, is encouraging. We see honest federal public servants saying there's a problem. The speaking notes and the presentation notes don't necessarily go to this degree of accuracy, but at least there were people plugging on the inside trying to do the right thing. Here's how are they covering off the shortfall? Some of you would have seen the Minister of Aboriginal Affairs making announcements for more money for schools. Does anyone remember that in the paper? We're making more money for schools. Well, what we found was this document, which showed that in order to cover off the shortfalls, because really, child welfare is a statutory program, right? They got to pay for it. They're not paying enough, but they're going to pay something. And there's shortfalls in income assistance and education as well. So to cover those off, they're taking the money from schools, the Building Schools Fund, and the Building Houses and Building Water Fund, and transferring that over to cover the shortfalls, to the tune of $500 million. Now, what the Winnipeg Free Press said about this is they said, you know, first of all, this really raises questions about the authenticity of government funding announcements. But it also, they're always, the government of Canada is always after First Nations leadership for transferring money from one pool to another. And yet, behind the scenes, they're doing it to this order of magnitude, right? So you can see there, that's a significant amount of money. And you can see that there's not enough money in that infrastructure thing in the first place, right? It's not as if there's a huge surplus there and we're just taking money over. Now, if you're the government lawyers and you've seen all these documents go in and your witnesses have talked to them, what are you going to say in your final written submissions in your defense? This is actually from the federal government's final written submission. You can read the entire document online. You can actually watch the closing arguments entirely online. I hope that you do. And you can see there that we, the complainants, that would be ourselves and the AFN, rely on an assortment of internal government documents. which we assert are admissible for the truth of their content. Imagine this. We're actually saying that the government documents must be truthful, right? As either public documents or admissions against interests. The federal government says they're not admissions. These are personal views of their employees. Regarding the Auditor General's report, they say it should be given very little weight because we did not call the Auditor General to testify. But the Auditor General's Act forbids the Auditor General from testifying in any legal proceeding in the country. And it doesn't note that the federal government in the Auditor General's reports say they agree with all the recommendations. I think the biggest indicator of how weak the government of Canada's case is when you look at expert witnesses. We called expert witnesses on our side, and the federal government had the ability to call the same. And they had KPMG, the accounting firm, lined up to do it. So they had KPMG go, remember I told you we worked on those solutions and we costed them out? They got KPMG to go through those numbers and produce a report. The problem for the federal government is that KPMG agreed with us. Their calculations came within 0.12% of our calculations. So we actually filed the federal government's expert report as evidence on our side. So thank you to the federal government for funding that. We didn't have to do that. Needless to say, the federal government decided not to call KPMG as an expert witness. So they have no expert witnesses. So we are... through the evidentiary phase, it's taken us 8 years. We are at the Caring Society. We lost all of our federal government funding within 30 days of filing the complaint. So we're the only longest standing national Aboriginal organization that receives no money from the federal government. And we're proud of that. We'd rather be small and stood up on principle. And I'm prepared to sacrifice the organization if necessary, because there are 163,000 childhoods that are much more important than any organization will ever be. So this is one of the teenagers who came back to the hearings. A new one came. And this is what he wrote. He said, the Caring Society and AFN have this case in the bag, he says. And I wish that the new laws would be put in place protecting the rights of First Nations children. And it really shows to me how you can bring in people who don't know a lot about this stuff. But people know right from wrong. You don't need to be a judicial expert to understand what's right from wrong. And one other thing about the Caring Society is every Valentine's Day, we host the biggest Valentine's Day party in Ottawa. And what we do is we invite all these kids to send Valentine's so First Nations kids can grow up safely in their families, get a good education, be healthy and proud of who they are. And you can, thanks to Amnesty, they've got hearts in the back, so you can do it. And guess where all the Valentines go? To the Prime Minister. And the kids will show up on Parliament Hill and they will read their letters and their poems directly to the Prime Minister. So this is us out there that day. And so you might want to know what some of the letters are, right? So one kid gets up there and says, you know, I'm in girls hockey. And kids do not know what a conservative is. They do not care what a liberal is, and they don't care what an NDP is. But they do know what a warm house is, what love is, what good food is. And if you really cared about kids in this house, you would do what my hockey coach says. He says, you have to play for the team on the front of the sweater, not the team on the back of the sweater. And all of the Canada's kids live on the front of the sweater. And we need you to do the right thing. Another little guy steps up to the plate and he says, dear Prime Minister Harper, do you have a cat? I have a cat. His name is Micah and he's a boy and he's black. And of course, we know the Prime Minister has many cats because the wife is involved in a lot of the SPCA ventures. And then he gets right down to business. He says, Stephen Harper, listen to me. If you do not build more schools, you're going to create a crime wave and lose all of your money. Because kids who cannot get an education cannot get jobs, and they're still going to need money when they grow up. So some of them are going to have to steal it. And then people in the community are going to get mad because crooks are invading their homes. So you better man up right now and fix this problem because you're in charge. You know, kids understand discrimination. And that's why they keep on coming back every Valentine's Day. And they're not there to make the government feel bad. They're there because they believe that adults can do better. They really do. Is equality really that hard? They ask. Is it really that hard? And just to give you a little sneak preview and inspire some of your Valentine's Day writing, that's what a couple kids in Ottawa were doing yesterday. Writing their Valentines. You know, I've always said, when I did the opening statement for the Caring Society at the Tribunal, and I said this to the Tribunal members, do not decide this case in favor of the Caring Society. I don't think the lawyers were very happy with that. And I said, and do not decide it on behalf of the Government of Canada. Make the best decision for children, and we will all win. We will all win. You know, this case is about kids, and kids are showing us what reconciliation really is. It's not about standing silent. It's not about making excuses. It's about standing up when you're needed. And if we all manage to do that, just imagine if all of us in this room sent a Valentine's Day, and when the ruling came out, we tweeted that ruling. We wrote to our member of parliament. We told our neighbors about it. Don't you think it would be a wonderful thing that by Canada's 150th birthday that we finally turn the page on this long history of racial discrimination towards First Nations children and one towards a future where all of our children can feel proud of the history that we left them? And if we finally do that, maybe one day, maybe Charlene and I will be walking along the street in Ottawa and Shelby will see that house again. And she'll say to us, can you see what they're doing there? And we'll say, yeah, they're laying sod. And she said, yes. They're making it look beautiful because what happens in that house is beautiful for children. That's the day we're all hoping for. Thank you all for coming.